Our guest today to Green Space is Isaac Pickle. Here's a little bit of the official bio for Isaac. Raised in Michigan near the back of his parents' used bookstore, Isaac Pickle is a biracial poet and PhD candidate at Wayne State University in Detroit, where he teaches and studies the borderlands of Blackness and Black literature. A graduate of Miami University's MFA program, his work's been featured in Black Warrior Review, Crazy Horse, Denver Quarterly, Fence, The Missouri Review, and Ninth Letter. You can find his newest stuff online at Perhappen, Protean Magazine, or ProLib. Black Lawrence Press published his chapbook, Everything Saved Will Be Last, in 2021. Black Ocean will be publishing his forthcoming full-length debut, It's Not Over Once You've Figured It Out, in 2023. His dissertation project, Passing Over, Passing Through, Transgressive Ambiguity Beyond the Color Line, reimagines the literary and cultural history of passing through its growth as a contextually bound cultural phenomena applied not only to race, but other socially constructed and rigid categories which preoccupy the American landscape, including gender, sexuality, and citizenship. By developing passing as a critical lens for considering various representations of ambiguous identity, Isaac hopes to promote analysis of other category crises grounded in and sensitive to the ongoing story of racial passing. Okay, so that's the official bio. As I read Pickle's poems, I found them endlessly compelling, orchestrating an intensity of thought and historical and theoretical reference. They may say, considering the borderlands of race in settler colonial history in compelling terms, then the social and ideological underpinnings of the production of that history across the break of a line. That might sound thinky, and it is, but at the same time, in many of Pickle's poems, is a figure that is vulnerable. As in, say, the poem, quote, "We are more than mere endurance," that ends with the lines, "telling whole stories in a flurry of blurred reminiscence with ourselves as the center, cowering from the helpless terror of being just one person." And in many of Pickle's poems is a sort of incomparable precision, or maybe we should call it care or carefulness, that in my reading seems intent on the incommensurability and inexchangeability of things. That's there to defend his subject from all the foreclosures that representation in this moment might inflict. So that poem I just read, it ends like this, quote, "But the math for empathy isn't supposed to add up, I say to my body softly." That said, part of the work is how it so easily exceeds and eludes these descriptive sketches. What I'm saying is read it. And also that we're so glad Isaac is here with us and that we get to ask him questions. Welcome to Green Space.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So reading your work and its rigor and surprise and its invitation to think carefully with it makes me just so curious about the thinkers that you're currently in conversation with. So what thinkers excite you right now, Isaac?
So I think it's not a surprise, since you ask these questions to everyone, which I have clarified to be certain, that we get these questions in advance, right? We're meant to think through them and prepare, and if not prepare, to ponder, and if not to ponder, to reflect, and if not to reflect. You get the point here. And I did a lot of that, and I spent some time reflecting and imagining the way that I sort of engage with thinkers. And what I realized is that the thinkers that excite me right now so often are just the thinkers that I'm working with in my scholarly work. And I am hesitant to say that those are the thinkers, the poets, the writers, the theorists that really engage with my creative work, only because I really do make an effort to sort of focus on the work that I'm doing as work. Because it really isn't fun. It was meant to be. I joined a PhD program to enjoy myself. I certainly did not do it for the $22,480 a year. I did for various other reasons. But I do want it to really sit there as work. And I really don't want poetry to be that, because I don't make any money for poetry. I usually lose money on it based on, printing supplies. And so I... I really do separate these things. And, you know, when I first thought through this, my answers were, okay, so like I can talk about like what I've read from Mark Fisher, because like that is interesting and important and everyone reads Mark Fisher and so do I, and I have a lot to say about capitalism. And I could talk about Christina Sharp, and I've riffed before on Christina Sharp and what I consider like her pronouns of knowing. I put that in air quotes because I don't think she actually says that. I think that I wrote that down in notes one time and have decided that it is what she says. But this idea that there are I's and we's that should be writing the stories, right? That when we're writing stories and calling them theory, it's important that those stories are done by people who can claim the first person, whether that's singular or plural. And I get a lot from C. Riley Snortons of the world, right? Which is someone who sort of introduced me to the idea of the intersection between racial and gender passing in the first place, which is at least in my scholarly work, really where I'm centering, is this idea that there is something inherently tethered between gender and race that not only happens at the obvious level, where we all think to the 19th century and the invention of contemporary race as the same time as the invention of contemporary gender, but also passing in those cases is really tied together closely in a way that Snorton talks about and then performs in their work. I'm fascinated by people who have nothing to do with my work, but I've read in graduate seminars and on my own bookshelf, like CNI and Berlant, rest in peace, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, I got this question right a long time ago. And after I started listing off thinkers that interested me, I realized that I was sort of no closer to answering the question of what thinkers excite me, because all those people I was thinking through with my work brain, right? And they excite me because it's something that I can like generate from. It's something that I will like write paragraph after paragraph about. You guys cannot see me dabbing my brow, thank God. Now I've just let out the secret. And you know, I realized that I had sort of a choice to make, and I alluded to this when I was introducing myself to Joe and Jacob earlier, which is that I had a choice to make between sort of answering these questions, all of them, in a way that produced sort of interesting answers, and in a way that was sort of more honest to my poetic practice. And I think that I, for a long time, and I'm sure it'll come up, I try to toe the line between those two. But ultimately, I think that I'm more interested in sort of answering these questions as, I don't know, theoretically agnostic as possible. Because I don't think that I have frankly, a good enough handle on sort of the way that theory contends with non-theoretical questions or questions outside of their own research in order to do them justice. And I know some of the people you've had on do have that sort of inherent skill. But I don't want to stumble through it. So I'd rather just sort of make my way through in the way that's easiest. So what I'm best at is sort of like talking through things and writing poems. That's what I do best. I wish that I could do that for a career. I can't, which maybe I can someday. After the revolution, there will be space for me to talk. And people will be like, wow, I like listening to you talk. You seem to enjoy yourself. And I'll be like, yeah, I love listening to the sound of my own voice. And maybe what I'm saying is that I am the thinker that excites me the most, which is a terrible thing to say, but it may yet be true. And so I sort of approach these questions, all of them, and this one in particular, trying to figure out the answer to how I should approach questions in general. And hopefully I'll do it well enough. And part of it is that, again, as you framed the question, you know, what thinkers get me to the kind of poetry that I write. And I think I write sort of theoretically adjacent poetry or philosophically adjacent poetry. I write the kind of poems that someone who's been through now 8 years of graduate school might write if they were, because a lot of people have been through 8 years of graduate school, and I'm not quite so humble to say that everyone writes poems just like I do. But I've sort of allowed myself to make that my lingua franca of my poetry world. And, you know, I try to approach poetry on its own terms. I don't know if you know Rob Halpern. Most people do, but maybe not everyone does. Sort of controversial poet who I after dropping out of college, the first time I went back to school at Eastern Michigan University, the Fighting Eagles. And I think that's what they call themselves. They used to be something offensive, you know, a bygone Native American tribe that was murdered in order to allow for the land grant university to exist. But now they're the Eagles. Anyways, he always talked about poetry as a sense organ or a sensuous organ, right? And he means to say it's a feeling organ. It's like whiskers or fingertips in the dark. And I, despite at first finding that to be almost too cute, the longer that I sort of sat with it over the course of now, I mean, I last had Rob in a classroom 10 years ago, I've sort of bought fully into that concept, that that is what poetry is. It's not a way to comment, it's a way to feel things out. And so in order to sort of approach these questions, I tried with a lot of them to write poems at them. And you'll see that here as we go through the questions. I've written poems at all of them. I won't be sharing all of them because some of them are very stilted and awful, but some of them are worth sharing, I think. So I realized that I've talked now for 10 minutes, sort of avoided answering the question. I am inspired by a lot of thinkers. I'm clearly excited by them, but I think it's important for me to separate the people who I work with from the people who I poem with, which, you know, I could say, like, do you guys know Kevin Latimer? The poet Kevin Latimer? He's from what we'll call the Cleveland School, I guess. It's a bunch of new poets out of Cleveland who are doing pretty interesting work. He's a thinker that excites me, right? Like that's who I want to be excited by when I'm doing poetry, is poets that are kind of doing more thinking than I think most people do within the work, because that's what I try to do myself. So I guess the shortest way to say it is, the thinkers who excite me, here's my quotable, because you gotta have one, at least one thing. The thinkers who excite me most are the ones who do most of their thinking by seeking, rather than by commenting. I love a good commenter. I think most of our great American thinkers and not American thinkers are commenters at heart, where they are approaching a set of facts about the world and trying to say something about it. But I personally prefer the ones who don't really know where they're going, and sort of lash out with words, figure out where to go from there.
That's great. There's so many different kind of threads that are worth kind of following in everything that you just said there. I really like that distinction you're drawing, because there is this tendency to collapse kind of the work, especially as a PhD student, that you're doing on the kind of critical side of things, and as that bleeds into your poetry, right? Thinking about what it means to actually think of these as separate processes that kind of actually can be parsed out. And so that makes me kind of think, and I really liked, as you're pointing to, Halpern's idea of poetry as this sense organ. Also, the image of the whiskers is very vivid and, yeah, like very tactile as well. So
it's really accurate too, right? That's a really accurate image, I think, for what poetry does. I think
absolutely
Halpern's
also a, like sea yeah. lion whiskers for some reason in my brain. Like it's not even like a you know, the go-to examples of whiskers. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, it's that is really, really great. And I think so that kind of maybe sets the stage a little bit for a possible direction you would go. But I'd be interested to hear kind of what you like art or writing to do to you, or what do you want art or writing to do to you?
I think the number one thing that I want art or writing to do to me is to make me have questions or to copy it. Those are the two main kind of directions that I go. So the most important is that if I'm approaching art of any sort, whether it's, you know, I wandered around the DIA a couple weeks ago. Am I muted? No, I'm not. I wandered around the DIA, the Detroit Institute of Art, and there are, you know, always these revolving exhibits, and some of them are really naive. There seems to be a lot of naive art at the DIA pretty consistently. I think it's partly their sometimes successful attempts to bring in outsider art, which I think is a really wonderful ideal. And I think that because they are such like a big institution-y institution, as all metropolitan art museums are, I think sometimes they fail at really accessing outsider art. So they end up with naive art and call it outsider art. The best thing that I could make from this one display, which was these series of Day of the Dead displays, shrines, as it were. And the best thing that I got from that was just all the questions that I had, the questions on form, the questions on why these existed in this space, questions about who these people were and what these people who are passed would think about their own enshrinification, which is something that I've often thought about, maybe more often than most living people do. And you know, the one thing that I could find in common between that and like the 4,000-year-old Persian metal casting and the wonderful pieces of art in what is clearly the best exhibit in the DIA is the African-American art, which is sort of like the calling card of the museum, or the institute, sorry, DIA for calling you a museum. The one thing in common there was that I was always, when it was working, I was always having questions. And that's really what I want. If I'm looking at art, I want to be aggravated into questioning, and not aggravated, angry, right? But agitated into it, maybe is what I mean to say. I want to not think idly by or ponder it or reflect. I hate reflecting on things. I personally find it to be boring. A, and beyond boring, it's lazy, right? Reflecting is what you do in a mirror. And so I want something to demand questions of me. And that's what I think I like art to do to me is sort of force me into having to contend with what I think about it. And then the other thing that I like art to do is I like to be inspired to sort of copy it. And I'm not the best copycat there ever was. There are some artists who really can just like see a form and do it. And it is someone that I know personally. So I'm going to shout out random poets that I know personally. It's just not fair, but I guess everyone does. But Taylor Bias, who is like this formal master. She's sort of a new poet. She is very much up and coming and will be someone that you know the name of before long. But she's a formal master, and she does so in a way that is like truly incredible, where she can take a Sistina and then it's like, wait, it's not a Sistina anymore. It's a Taylor Bias poem, but I could have sworn. And she just does this copycat that is, I don't know, frankly inspiring. And I try to do the same thing, though. For me, I think more than more than form, I tend to take material. So whether that's language, if I'm working with something written, but more often sort of literal material, if it's an artwork or if it's like a subject matter from more prosaic writing. I really like to, not copy it is the wrong word, but use it as sort of a launching point. And I think that is probably my number two, after asking questions, my number two thing that I want art to do is I want it to make me want to do something just like that. Oh, I also want to write a poem about sea lion whiskers now. Right. And like, I'm not gonna be able to put that down. And it probably will show up somewhere. And I think that, man, I don't know. This was a tricky question because I the word like here, as if I have a choice, I thought was really interesting. And especially, you know, doing to me. Because I can't actually like, you know, approach the art or the writing or the thought and tell it like, hey, you know what? I would like you to do this to me. And so I think I was a little tripped up when trying to work through what I might say to this, because what I would like art to do maybe is something different than what it actually does do to me, or what I would like art to do is different than what art does when I appreciate what it is doing, right? So I can appreciate what art does to me at times, and that be different than what I would pick and choose for art to do. Which maybe if I could pick and choose, it would teach me something every single time, right? If I could just say like, what would I like art to do? I would like to learn, and I think that I could make the argument that I learn every time I have an engagement with the arts, but I think that's probably bullshit. But I think that's what I would, if I had a perfect world, I would like it to be teaching me all of the time, and just sort of sponge it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that makes a ton of sense. If we could just take something concrete away from every engagement, that would feel like a major win, instead of falling asleep as I often do, while cognitive process is shutting down. Our next question is forthcoming, but I also just want to say, I now want to write a poem and think about, like, before writing that poem, I'm putting my whiskers on, like, yeah. as a method of preparation. But you mentioned seeking. You mentioned, you know, that an engagement with art is often one that is, you know, raising questions or putting in process a method of a sort of, yeah, process of agitation, you know, out of which questions fall. And so, you know, I'm interested in the relationship between art and meaning making and everyday life, and if there is one for you, because one of our questions is how do you access meaning or meaningfulness in your everyday life or your daily life, and you know are your engagements, you know, with art as a writer and a PhD student a part of that, or is there a separation there?
Yeah, I, this was one of the moments where I really wanted to hear from both of you, just in the simplest of terms of how do you do this, but how meaningful are you able to make your daily life?
Wow. And okay.
Yeah. Just this scale of 1 to 10 or not.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question because, you know, I think as I've been in different sort of phases of my life, there have been times where I've worked at a shipping plant, like 10-hour shifts. And, you know, my life felt quite automated in those moments. And, you know, there were days that probably slipped by without me being able to name the meaning of that day. At the other hand, some days feel like pedagogical. Some days feel like they're filled with like, things that are resonant and that I'm taking something away from them. And, you know, one of the reasons I think I asked this question, and, you know, I won't speak for Jake, is that I think we composed these during the COVID lockdown. And so that was a major question for us. And it's still a major question for me, because I felt so many days go by in the stream without a process of gathering or reflection or of, you know, meaning an active, engaging in an active meaning-making process of the stuff that was my life on my own behalf. So how do I do that? Yes, I need help, Isaac. Okay, go ahead, Jake.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was like particularly entwined or intertwined with even asking the question. Like, by asking the question is one of the methods through which I think I have tried to extract meaning. Is, you know, by each day returning to, or at least each time we do one of these interviews, returning to that question and hearing how other people do it is a nice reminder.
That's wonderful. I think that's one of the better answers I've heard ever to a question like this, which is that I keep asking the question until it clicks. Thank you both for indulging me there, and I wanted to ask, maybe for Jacob's exact reason, which is that I really struggle to access meaning and meaningfulness in my daily life. I really, really do, in like a deep-seated dealing with this question felt like a therapy session sort of way. I grew up afraid of death in a way that I think is not natural for young children. Every child grows up afraid of death, but I was like racked with it, couldn't sleep for years on end because of it. And I haven't really gotten out of that yet. And I think part of, you know, the worst cliche reason that I make poetry, aside from I need something to help me figure out the world around me, is that, you know, I am so terrified of it's not death anymore, right? I've moved past the idea of death. I think there's a spectrum of life and death. Your plants die, my hair falls out, etc. But limitlessness of time really, really racks me. And so I, as I turn toward adulthood sometime, you know, in the Bush administration, I really wanted to find a way to sort of outlast what I at the time was sure would be a short life, and I'm still not sure it won't be. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, that idea of being taught all of the time from our last question, like, that's a way to make meaning in life, is like constantly soaking up information. I'm one of those people who, you know, get sucked into Wikipedia holes for 4 or 5 hours. And it's not because I'm necessarily like interested in any of the specific answers that I'm getting. It's because I'm interested in the compendium of answerness that Wikipedia can offer me, and that all of its sources can, right? This sort of like endless stream of information that I can sort of apply to my future and to the futures of those people around me. And that I think, at least in my older work, which you can spot here and there still on the internet, really speaks to that, where I have a lot of poems that are really just research poems, where I will, a few of them are published, but I'll have found a subject that seems fascinating, and I'll just like go. I just need to know everything there is to know about it. The smaller the subject, the better. But that doesn't get us anywhere closer to understanding how I access meaning in my daily life. And I do spend a lot of days just sort of in the stream, in the churn, whatever metaphor we want to use here. And I think that the way that I find some sort of meaningfulness in those days, the days that just sort of go by, is by, I don't even know how to say it. Man, it's so cheesy, but it's true. It's just like, it's the limitedness of it. I have lived through some 12,000 days, give or take my math, and you can cut this part if you want to, but I want to see how close my approximation is. Do you know what I'm basing? You can keep it if you want to. Do you know what I'm basing this approximation on? Is in the Truman Show, he turns 10,000 days old, and I know that I'm slightly older than he was. So 35.8 times 365. No, I'm 13,000 days old. Yeah. My apologies. Oh. But that was way off. 1,000 days. God, Truman was young. So anyways, well, back to the plan. So I've lived 13,000 days, and in that time, like, I have done so many things. Every single day is just full of stuff, and maybe I have 13,000 days left, and they will be so full of things, and then it will just be over, right? And it's that idea of the precarity of life. Not the precarity of the resource of life, right? That makes me feel meaningful, because, you know, to bring it back to the original, like, I'm going to die and life will go on forever without me, or time will go on forever without me. And, you know, the fact that I will have had these few days and tried to do something with them makes those days feel really meaningful. And I don't know. I don't know how to answer this question any better without, frankly, making myself really, really sad. Maybe that's good, right? Not every question needs to be thinky or instructive. And I don't think it's sad because it's like a downer of an answer, but just because, you know, the idea of meaningfulness is sort of necessarily set against the reality of what is ultimately here today, gone tomorrow sort of existence. So I don't know. I hope that people who write poetry or write thought, thinkers and poets alike, I hope that they use their work as a way, not for themselves personally to like live on into infinity, but for their ideas to live on as something that sort of carries forth meaning.
Yeah, I really love that. It's a really useful to have that kind of tension, you know, that you're pointing towards in this somewhat impossible task of articulating meaning in the face, right, of this total dislocation of the self and finitude, right, that you're facing. And it raises I'm worried we're going to keep going in a dark direction with things, but it could also totally shift because I like this question. But what is I'm interested in thinking about this around the ideas of waste. And so, you know, it's we've borrowed lots of these questions from other artists and poets that we really like. This one comes from Paul Thek. And yeah, it's the question is just, what is waste?
Unmute. Sweet. This is also my favorite question, I think. I really had fun with this. And I don't think it's sad at all or a downer of a question.
Good.
I actually think a lot of ways waste, though I didn't necessarily take my answer here when I was preparing, but I want to sidetrack just for a moment. I think waste can be like a wonderful thing. Like, I love wasting time. I think that's wonderful. I like, you know, going to the bathroom while I'm on the clock. Like, I love, like, you know, like, that's a wonderful thing. We think of waste as like necessarily like a negative. And I just don't think that that's really what it is. I waste words. When I try to do my own naive art, which I do draw very poorly and make diagrams very poorly, and I'm super inspired by people who make like hand-drawn infographics, and I want to do that myself and try to as best as I can. But those are all like, those are wasteful processes for me, because it's not anything that will ever see the light of day, or, you know, besides to my closest confidants. But I am just sort of like, I'm wasting my energy there. And I think that in the same way that we do need to go to the bathroom to survive, I think that we need to waste our energy and our time as well. I think that if we are not ever sort of contending with our own byproducts of our productivity, we're sort of fucked. But before I go any further, I did when I was first approaching this question, I wrote a poem. And so I want to share it, if I may, and then maybe speak a little further about the question in some time. The poem is titled, "Waste is something that happens and not something that is." Before the production of wreckage stands a lack of vision, trust, placed in the fact of finished as a model for life and not creation. Before excess obstinates the magistrate for a pensioner only promised a future that's finite and aseptic. Before debris waits a whetted knife sentenced to shelter, before crumbled, before excrement, before the production of rot, filth, and ruin is everything no longer called home. An unseeing nod and the gesture you were not hoping for. The people who won the war and then the war and then the war and then the war over the words use and used. Nostalgia as an end in itself. But who is going to tell any of this to November squirrels, discovering waste and naming it salvation, and everything else we've claimed can't be broken down? So in other words, right, waste should be nothing that we are sad or weary about.
Yeah, I love that poem. I love the pause between filth and ruin is everything no longer called home. Yeah. Well, while we're on the embrace waste train, maybe this is a good time to ask the question, you know, that might follow from wasting time and the deliciousness of that. But this is another Paul Thek question. What is leisure? And there's a crying baby, so I'm going to relocate as you answer this question.
Okay. My own child is not home at the moment. So we have no excess noise. Thank goodness. So what is leisure? The one note, because I knew I would just be able to talk on this for a while, but hopefully everything eventually. Right. That is, I think, my goal for leisure is that it sort of it takes up all of our time. And of course, that isn't at the expense of thinking or art or work, even in many sort of ways. But my ultimate hope is that leisure, however it is defined, and I guess that's what we're working on here, that leisure sort of ends up replacing those things as the key defining factor of those modes of being. So that if you are working, you can be working, you can be tilling land or writing a dissertation. And ultimately what you are doing by doing those things is being at leisure. And you can be making art and you can be writing poems or you can be splaying paint across a canvas. And the core of what you're doing by doing that act is being at leisure. And, you know, I think that this is sort of a dream, but a dream is a rather soft place to land. And so I'm really happy with that as like a defining feature of leisure. I also, you know, have in here that, do you, either of you know the game Strays? It's a video game.
It's called Strays. Sort of. It's, there's a cat, right? Is it a cat? And you go places as the cat.
There's a cat. So okay, first off, right. it may be the most beautiful video game I've ever witnessed. I don't have a video game system. I did grow up in a bookstore. That's not a joke. The tagline, funny enough, for the bookstore was "Everything your mother made you throw away." So my father also believes in a wasteless society. He also happens to be the most nostalgic person I've ever met, much to his fault. But I never grew up with video game systems. I still don't have any, except for my computer machine. But my friend, my best friend Hannah, who's a poet herself, shout her out. She plays this game, and it's gorgeous. It feels like a sunset all of the time, even when it's not. But the idea in this game is that, sure, you have something that sort of approaches missions, and you're in a robot city. It's not quite post-apocalyptic, but it's certainly post-happy times. And you're just a cat. You don't have magical anthropomorphic powers. You can't speak to people. You can't answer complex questions. You can't figure things out. All you can do is do exactly as cats do, which is leisure about the world around you, trying to make it out alive. And I think that, like, I've sat and watched this game. I've never played it. I've sat and watched it for hours, and it's felt almost meditative, because ultimately what's happening in this game is you are a character at leisure and you have a goal. And being some creature with a goal does not get in the way of your leisurely activity. Sometimes the best thing for you to do is curl up in a little corner and rest. And that's how you figure out the answer to your problem. And so I guess to bring it back to something that sort of approximates an answer to Thek's question, I want leisure to be everything, because I want everything that we do to be able to be done through leisure. I don't want us to feel at odds with it when we are in other modes of existence. Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, it, right, converting this idea of leisure as like almost this just mode of being, as opposed to like this isolated little like oasis, right, that exists separate from the rest of your life. I really like that. And as you were talking there's a lot of discussion of this as a like a dream space, talking a little bit about nostalgia and then video games and these sort of simulated experiences, kind of was just making me think of one of our other questions, and probably my favorite question, which is, what's something you believe even though it's probably not true?
Time travel. Hard stop. Time travel.
Yes.
Yeah. If time travel isn't true, I don't want to be true. I think that what's the Fermi paradox? You guys familiar with the Fermi paradox, right? This idea that, so we live in a galaxy amidst 100 million other galaxies, amidst, right, tens of thousands of other super galaxies in a universe that's constantly expanding. And we have radio waves and microwaves and civilization and misogyny and everything else that we've invented, for better or worse. And we've never ran into any other living creature anywhere. And not only have we never ran into any other living creature, we've never even ran into any evidence that any creature has ever lived. And so the Fermi paradox basically says, like, what are the odds that we haven't ran into aliens? It seems almost kind of strange. Like, it's not that big of a galaxy. And there are, we're now recognizing, after Fermi, you know, proposed his paradox, we're recognizing there are hundreds of millions of exoplanets just in the Milky Way. And all those exoplanets, those hundreds of millions of planets, have room for hundreds of millions of societies that all maybe should be able to communicate with each other, you know, Star Trek style. So the question that Fermi proposes basically is, what is a possible explanation for us never running into other aliens? And he basically says, like, okay, there's option A, which is that we just aren't advanced enough to hear it yet, right? We're barely, we are what, 60 years off the planet, right? From 70 years since Sputnik or whatever, right? So we've only been off the planet for 70 years. And in cosmic time, that's like a blip of a blip. So his one answer is just like, we just can't hear it yet. Our ears haven't been tuned. But his other answer is like, maybe advanced societies like don't want to have anything to do with unadvanced societies. Okay, maybe. But maybe the reason there aren't all these like thousands of advanced societies is because once societies get advanced, they just fucking self-destruct. And he thinks that's the most likely answer to his paradox of why no aliens, which is that, you know, you just advance and advance and advance and you blow yourself up. We already did it almost. And we're only 70 years in, 80 years into the nuclear age, right? And we're already almost to the point where through global pandemics and nuclear war and climate change, we're about to end the world on our own, right? So his kind of ultimate solution is like, that's probably the most likely answer. So given that as maybe my theoretical center for science fiction thinking writ large, which is that I think that we're probably more likely than not to hit sort of a bottleneck of advancement. I think that if we make it through that bottleneck, there's no way on earth that we wouldn't be able to invent time travel. And if we're able to invent time travel, there's no way in hell that we aren't going to invent time travel and then use it a whole bunch. People are infinitely curious. We travel all over the place, often for reasons that are really nasty. Not like nasty, like I'm going to destroy stuff, but just like minor nasty. And I can't imagine people being like, you know what? There are too many terrible implications behind time travel, so I'm not going to do it. People will absolutely time travel the second it is available. And because of that, I am certain that there are already time travelers and we just have not sort of ran across them. I think it exists. I think that when things feel sort of like they're out of the matrix, I don't think that we're living in a robot society. I think that time travelers are just messing with stuff. That is like a hard and fast belief that I have. I don't think it makes me into like a weird conspiracy theorist. I think it should just be like everyone should just accept it as fact that like, of course, we're going to invent time travel. And then once we do, you know, of course, people will use it. So, you know, when you have that moment in the Matrix where like you are sure that your shirt was blue and then you have weird deja vu and your shirt is red, that's just a time traveler. He has jumped in, changed your shirt, been like, ha ha ha, Isaac's wearing a red shirt now. And like, that's it. Just because, you know, why not? It'd be fun. So that's something that I sincerely believe, even though it's probably not true.
Okay. Well, it does seem like the way humans would use time travel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the implications of that are really upsetting and surprising and fun to think about. So yeah, while we're thinking about time travel and perhaps it being used to satisfy some strange desires, and, you know, and possibly like a whole economy of time travel, you know, and approaching a potentially like dystopic bottleneck in our future, we have a question that it originates from Bernadette Meyer's letter to Bill Berkson in 1981. What do you think of machines? question mark. And I think maybe what you just said answers that a little bit, but I wonder if there's anything else you'd want to add to this question. What do you think of machines?
Okay. I actually have a lot to say on this one. I think a lot about machines. So here's another one. I have a poem. Do you guys mind if I read another?
Not at all. Go for it. Yes.
Okay. So this one is called Froyo and Other Meritocracies. So, held serene by the unwavering embrace of virtue, frozen yogurt stands behind its chromed soft serve machines as a gleaming pinnacle of opportunity, pieced and priced in immaculate harmony with choice and chance to carry the same medley for all. Sprouting its arias of liberty, oaking high to be heard by each and every commuter who hugs tight to their well-soiled lane, the hills, the flood plains. The universe does not care to know that this vein loops through what we still call air, and that negotiates between ear and scum to hear it. The right to select the selection they hold most dear. Stitched into the tyranny of merit, people are taught to love what they afford, frozen to those tiny, tender hairs you grow when blessed by the first hammers of hunger. Have you learned what you want? Now go forth and make it. So, machines are a miracle for anyone who gets to control them, right? At least at the lever or at the dispensary button, right? Either the person who makes the machine or the person who gets to press it. You know, the little rat who always gets when they ask for cheese. And positioning myself here, I think, is important, which is that relatively, I get when I want, right? Not always what I want, but I do get something that at least approximates the satisfaction of need. So I trust machines somewhat inherently. I grew up middle class, not particularly comfortably in the middle class, but you know, we were a small business owner in the growth industry of used books. But I was taught well to like trust in the power of machines, from mechanical to political to social, whatever, any manifestation or connotation therein. I didn't have to unlearn this theoretically. I fell out of the middle class over the past 15 years, and was sort of taught how unforgiving machines can be when they don't work for you at all. But you know, the accelerating advance of machines has put more and more pressure on the disparate relationships that people have with them based on class or other forms of status, right? Systematized status, where one of the, let me actually read, because I thought through this a little bit. Can you cut out? Let me actually read. That's so embarrassing. Actually, maybe it's not. Yeah. So one of the obvious tragic consequences of our unyieldy system is that the better things get, the more profitable it becomes to manufacture scarcity, because people don't expect to deserve the cutting edge. So the cutting edge keeps running away from us. So like sooner or later, and I know I'm talking a lot about cats here today, but sooner or later, we're going to have little cat toys that have soft, supple bodies and working whiskers and chips instead of gears and little tiny feet and little tiny noses and little wants and needs. And they can learn your cat's habits and they can hide appropriately. And this will be a miracle. Your cat will never be happier. And you'll never be happier because with a little robotic AI mouse in your house, other mice won't come in. But they'll only make 8,000 of them. And they'll give away like 3 to children with incurable diseases, and the rest will go to the wealthiest families in the world. And so you think to yourself, well, that sort of sucks. This is a miracle technology. But at the same time, Do either of you feel like you would deserve this miracle cat toy? It sounds like the things of ridiculous fantasy, but someone is going to have that cat toy. It's just never going to be you. It's never going to be your children, and it's never going to be your children's children. And I think that, like, the further we get into the reaches of technology, the greater the span becomes between 98% of houses have a microwave and 0.01% of houses have realistic cat toys made out of, you know, microchips. And because of that, I think that, like, machines, however they are going to be increasingly used as a way to separate people, which I think is sort of sad, because I think, you know, for a long time, machines were a great equalizer. And you know, obviously the Industrial Revolution has its foibles. We don't have to go into them at the moment, but certainly on a non-global scale, the Industrial Revolution does bring the first sort of flares and, you know, like, gestures towards a mass equality, right? It allows for the sort of revolutionary spirit that we come to appreciate, and that I think probably all three of us are still sort of waiting to come to fruition. So I think that, like, machines are obviously miracles. And I think that they have the potential to do something that is really good for everyone. I think they do have meritocratic power, but I think ultimately, the more we become sort of a runaway capitalist technocracy, the more they're going to be used as a mode of separation between people. And, you know, like all miracles, they should be treated with like respect and apprehension. So I think a lot about machines.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, like, this has this deep, like, respect for the power of the machine, right? And the kind of potential housed within it feels really a useful kind of stance to approach it with. And so thinking, especially through your answer, right, so much of this has this kind of attention to the possibilities of the future. I'm curious to hear, you know, what you might think of. And again, this is another question coming from Bernadette Mayer, but it's her list of journal ideas and writing experiments. So it's, you know, giving you space to explore a bit. And the question is, what is the writing or poetry, writing or medium of the future?
Yeah, thank you for this question. It's a wonderful one, and it's one I did take the prompt and journal on to some extent that I won't be sharing here, because I think it's sort of still in process, and I want to keep thinking it through. But it was, I guess, for me, and you might get this sense based on some of my other answers, the future is really, really, really big for me. I have trouble thinking of the future as, you know, 2050 or 2070. And so this question sort of, in many ways, sort of flattened me right on my butt, because I started thinking of what is the poetry or the writing or the medium of 3300 AD. And I just, man, that's something. But I think that if we nail it down to maybe our lifetimes, right? I think that, and this is sort of painful for me to say, but I think it's just true, that poetry in particular is going to have to sacrifice the page. Right now, right, we all sort of understand, like, the line is the unit of poetry and the second unit of poetry is the page. I think that we are going to have to sacrifice the page. And I think that's because if poetry is going to continue to exist as something of its own sort of independent art form, it's going to have to do so in the way that so much poetry is going right now, which is by sort of perverting the way that space can work. space meaning two-dimensional space right now, but I think eventually three-dimensional space. So I'm thinking of poets like C.A. Conrad, right, or Taihim Bajess, who already sort of make waste with what was the left margin, or even the right margin, or even the center margin, and play all across the page in ways that doesn't even pay like homage to this idea of like a settled margin, a settled space, a place where the page goes, a place where the writing goes. But I think that we have to sort of like play way beyond that to three-dimensional spaces. And I'm really excited to see what happens with that. I think that poetry as a three-dimensional object is sort of a fascinating possibility. And I say this as someone who doesn't really explore the space of the page all that much in my own work. I mean, I'll fuck around with the column. I'll mess around with some weird justifications, but ultimately I'm writing a lot of couplets, baby. But I really do want to see poetry sort of explore three-dimensional space. And I think it's a way to set us apart from some other forms of writing, especially like fiction and novels, right? Which sort of exist at the altar of narrative, where they're these just like objects that are just like telling a story for the sake of telling the story, and as clear as we can, even experimentally clear, we can do whatever the fuck we want. And I think because of that, it's really, really important to sort of work within technology as much as we can. And I see no reason not to have you know, a poem that, like, I'm in a three-dimensional room right now, and there's no reason that I shouldn't be able to press a button 30 years from now and project my poem on a three-dimensional space. And the ways I think it just opens up so many possibilities of contrapuntal reading, of different ways of approaching language, of how language should be read, right? How we should approach it. Is it linear? Is it not? That I think, yeah, like the core of my answer here is that I think that the poetry of the future has to sort of give up on print space and white space and has to sort of explode beyond the page.
Hmm. Yeah, I really like that. And when I think of my favorite part of C.A. Conrad's works, it's sort of the what happens between the instructions and the actual poem that comes out of that. So in a way, it's like an intermedia kind of text, in the same way that somebody projecting onto a room would, you know, what the poem is kind of a simultaneous experience of a lot of things at once. So yeah, I mean, this is an exciting poetic future, right? I like it. So, I mean, you mentioned your own current practice, which is, you know, maybe defined by the margin or couplets and tercets. And we're also thinking about the future. So let's bring these things together. What do you want your intellectual or artistic practice to look like in 20 years?
Okay, so this is the last poem I'm going to share, if that's all right. We got one more. But before I do, I want again to sort of press on what is like an inescapable problem of word choice here, which is that what I want my intellectual and artistic practice to look like in 20 years, the amount of agency I have over that is so slim because of what might happen to the world. And hell, what might happen to me. And I just, you know, if I have an idea of what my, like what I want my artistic practice to be, it would be like, you know, I would love my artistic intellectual practice to be like propagandist for like a successful movement. Like that would be wonderful, but we don't have any successful movements. So as it is, I'm sort of stuck writing, you know, poems about like, you know, my sort of insignificant existence as, you know, white passing individual, which like ultimately I want to, you know, put this on record. I am very self-aware of how kind of unimportant my subject position is as a position of alterity. I get to choose to live as like a white male whenever I want to. The only people who ever know that I'm mixed are other people of color. White people never have any clue whatsoever. So if I'm walking through South Georgia, I'm just like, yes, officer, I can't believe it either. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they were speeding. And there's no problem. So, but that being said, you know, I focus on that sort of work for a reason, which is that I think that it really speaks to the way that, like, the way that we categorize race and the way that we categorize categories is important to look at the borders to begin with. But that is getting off the point. The point here is that I don't get to really choose my practices because I'm way more interested in what's happening in the world and reflecting on it. So honestly, that was all a rambly preamble to this poem. So we're gonna read one more. It's titled, "I Try to Ask What I Want for Myself and the World Answers." I am always writing toward a positionality to play at obsession. To play, it cannot be your future if you are pretending you're in someone else's. To be a satellite throwing eyes to see the globe for what it really is. A buzzing Rube Goldberg machine calling itself a pearl. If you're high enough, you can call anything a center. I am the face of the extant environmental collapse, processing too slowly to know distance is a measure of time, removing the miracle of sight to let the world blur by me, a weaker contempt, assuming the world won't keep. What a cowardly way to end a poem. Forgiving your own practice for the sake of catastrophe's nine lives. I mean, there will always be something to echo. Write, but do everything to make it worth scoring. And that's, I think that's all I have to say about that. I don't know, guys. I want my intellectual and artistic practice to be fined by the world around me in 20 years. I really hope that something has changed, or if something has changed for the better, that I get to celebrate it in my work. And if something has changed for the worse, that I get to try to do something about it with my work. I think right now we're at sort of a hinge point where the world is totally fucked and we all know it, but it's fucked in a way that is so boring, ultimately, that it's really hard to comment on it and not feel like a tool of its own sort of inexorability. And so I hope the world has changed enough in 20 years that I can value what I have to say about it.
Okay, there are some incredible lines in there. The "what a cowardly way to end a poem" is one that sticks. And as you're saying, with the having just like the dumbest version, right, of apocalypse closing in, it makes me think like, what a cowardly way to end a world. Just a horrifying thought that's just echoing there. I believe this is our last question, and it does not, you know, smoothly move away from the bummer that we're caught in at the moment. But I'd be interested to know what you have been listening to lately. We're mostly just looking for recommendations of things to check out ourselves. So yeah, what has been going into your ears?
Right. So when I first approached this question, I had a feeling that you meant music recommendations, but I was like, mostly birds and the sounds of my own house. This is mostly what I listen to. I like the sound of my house a lot. It has like a real unique hum. And it's sort of high pitched in a way that I can actually access it. It's not just background noise. And I also live across the street from a couple of big apartment complexes, which means that there are like the birds avoid them. And because of that, the trees in my backyard are just constantly filled every season. So I listen to a lot of birds. But as far as like music goes, you know, I if you're looking for recommendations, I'm like deeply in the bag for Alice Phoebe Lou, and anyone else who has her kind of sound, which is, I don't know, somewhere between like, no, I don't want to try to give it a genre. Just listen to Alice Phoebe Lou. She's like a brilliant lyricist. She is full of yearning, and she is, her songs are full of bass. In a way that I think is like really, really works with the themes of her songs and her music. By the same token, I listen to a lot of Kate Bollinger. That's Kate Bollinger, who has, she's way straighter than Alice Phoebe Lou is, which is much to her detriment because honestly, like I've heard enough like straight love songs for a lifetime. But that being said, they're beautiful music and they're done really well. I really like the band Loving, is someone who I think makes me think a lot. And we said art makes me ask questions. Loving is always making me ask questions. They have a song that ends, if I am only my thoughts, let me be one, let me be one, which has just stuck with me and made me ponder almost endlessly. And then I kind of am like politically indebted to No Name. And so I like to listen to her music as well. And I think she's wonderful. And I think the kind of things she's trying to do outside of the music industry are really commendable. And I hope everyone, I hope more artists sort of take that path once they have enough fame to make it work. I also listen to a lot of just like Ethiopian tech, right? Like East African jazz, which I've been into for some years now and makes up most of my writing music. So if I'm sitting and writing, I'm putting on something like that. I could pull up artists, but maybe you can put them in the podcast notes because I don't feel like scrolling through my Spotify right now, nor pronouncing names wrong and making myself look like a doofus. So, yeah, that is probably the extent of my music recs for tonight. I know I've had you on the line now for almost an hour and a half, so I apologize for being so damn long-winded, but, you know, so it goes.
No, yeah, thank you so much. I mean, that is exactly what we're looking for, is a bunch of fantastic, recommendations, things to check out. A lot of stuff in there that I've never listened to, so that's really exciting. And yeah, your answers really were, you know, really generative spaces, both demonstrating kind of the process of thinking and arriving at these, and also immediately like sending off like sparks in my own brain. Yeah, I think we will all be stuck with the image of these sea lion whiskers a way of thinking what the poem as we move forward. But yeah, thank you so much for, you know, spending this time with us, hanging out here, and really excited to see you in a couple of weeks for our reading in a green space.
Thank you so much both for having me. This has been a real pleasure, and yeah. I'm looking forward to Buffalo as well.
Just before we finish up, do you have a website that you want to share? Any other places where people can access whatever you're working on?
Sure. I'm not sure it's like worth plugging, but isaacpickle.com, myholename.com. That's my website. There's not much on it. I used to write little book reviews on there for chapbooks, which I've written maybe 5 or 10 of those. I've recently taken it off because my partner told me it was gauche to have book reviews for other people's books on your own personal website. But I may put those back on in time because I really do like writing them, especially for the little books that don't get enough attention. So myfullname.com. That's probably the easiest way to find my work. Oh, I should also plug the Woodward Review, which is the kind of interdisciplinary literary journal that I'm currently the editor-in-chief of, though I hope to put it off into other hands. Friend of the pod, Vincent Perrone, is actually going to be our next editor-in-chief here pretty shortly. And, you know, I'm excited by the work that we're doing there, excited enough that I would love other people to go check it out. So, yeah, that's all I got.
Awesome. Thank you so much.